This time on your weekly Constitutional, what can we do about Nazi speech?
The problem is that using the government to suppress them means giving the government the power to decide what speech is so wrong, so dangerous, that we're going to ban it.
Eugene Volokh is very reluctant to allow government censorship. Richard Delgado has a somewhat different perspective.
Their speech and their program and their action threatens and endangers other constitutional values, such as equality. The government makes discretionary decisions in the area of speech all the time.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about Nazis and free speech.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Nazis and other political extremists make us wonder about our commitment to free speech. On the one hand, we don't like what they're saying, and we'd like them to go away. On the other hand, can we do that? Can we restrict what Nazis say without restricting our own speech? It's an age-old conflict between two constitutional values, freedom of speech on the one hand, and equality on the other. Today, I've got a real treat for you. I've got two very prominent law professors. First, Eugene Volokh, notable for the Volokh Conspiracy blog on the Washington Post, among many other accomplishments, and Richard Delgado, who is one of the founders of something called critical race theory. Let's start with Eugene.
I'm Eugene Volokh. I teach at UCLA Law School. I specialize in the First Amendment law. I teach it. I write about it. I litigate First Amendment cases. And I also write a blog that's currently hosted by the Washington Post called The Volokh Conspiracy, where my co-bloggers and I post on many things, often including the First Amendment.
I must say that's among the best blog titles I've ever encountered. The first time I saw it, I wasn't really sure what to make of it.
Yeah, well, it has the vices of its virtues, the virtues of its vices. On one hand, it sounds odd and maybe a little bit questionable, but it makes it intriguing. And in any event, it's become our trademark now, our brand, and we're stuck with it whether we like it or not.
Well, my wife and I, and she's also a law professor, she's currently at Vanderbilt, we enjoy it immensely, and she frequently will send me links to something that you or one of your conspirators have posted. So we're so happy to have you with us today. What do you think? You're the First Amendment expert. What do you think of all this Nazi stuff going on recently and the terrible circumstance especially that's arisen in Charlottesville recently? Should we be giving these Nazis their free speech rights, or should we be trying to suppress them somehow?
Well, can't stand Nazis, just like I can't stand communists and a wide but narrow range of other extremists, Islamofascists and the like. I think they have nothing really valuable to add to our debates. If somehow magically they all saw the light and stopped spewing their nonsense, that would be lovely. The problem is that using the government to suppress them, using government action to suppress them, means giving the government the power to decide what speech is so wrong, so dangerous, that we're going to ban it or otherwise punish it. And the Supreme Court has rightly refused to give the government the power to take particular viewpoints and try to excise them this way from public discourse. And one reason that I think this is wise is we already see how the movement to try to suppress the speech goes way beyond just Nazis, right? Look how broadly the term white supremacist, for example, is being used by those who disapprove of certain views, goes far beyond real white supremacy or real Nazism. Look how broadly the term fascist has historically been used. On the other side, look how during the 1950s, people were tarred with a brush of communism, even though they weren't communists, even though they didn't support communist tyranny. So we're seeing, just look at what's happening on campuses, just how much speech people are trying to suppress that is not Nazi speech, but they're trying to analogize it to speech such as by Nazis. And once the government gets the power to say, well, we're going to ban one viewpoint, it makes it much easier for the government, by analogy, to try to ban others.
Yeah, I've already revealed my position on this many times on this show and to my classes. I'm very much on your side when it comes to this sort of thing, and my analysis is very similar. I will confide to you that all the way back in law school in the 1980s, I lost a couple of friendships over this, because at that point, probably the most salient case was the Skokie case, the Skokie march by the Nazis. Basically, as you said, we can't start, or we can't let the government regulate who gets to speak, and therefore the Nazis get to march. And I was discussing this with a friend of mine in our third year of law school, and I commented that I thought that that was a self-evident outcome and that it was very well reasoned, and for all the reasons you've just said. And he just became incensed. He became absolutely incensed. He insisted that there were certain ideas, in this particular case, anti-Semitism, that should simply be taken off the table. Can't we simply declare that certain ideas are wrong? He kept insisting. And when I kept coming back at him by, you know, probing how this might morph into something more, eventually I said, maybe we should stop our conversation for the sake of our friendship. And he said, what friendship? And that was the last time I've spoken to him in 30 years. Is there some way to declare ideas off limits? Is there some way? Can't we find some horrible ideas out there and simply say these are off limits?
Well, in fact, actually, in our ordinary lives, we do this, right? We choose whom to invite to dinner based on their views. And we say, well, you know, somebody is, this person I disagree with, but I'm willing to have a civil conversation with. This person is beyond the pale. The problem is that once you allow the government to declare those ideas off limits, it runs away from you, right? You think you're just authorizing the government to ban idea X, and definitely not Y or Z. But now you're not in control. The government might say, or different governments throughout the country say, well, we think that this is just as bad, or close to as bad. Or if these ideas are being suppressed, why can't we suppress those ideas? If we can suppress anti-Semitic ideas, why not suppress anti-Muslim ideas? Well, if we can suppress anti-Muslim ideas, why not suppress anti-Islam ideas? Now, I actually think that a lot of the criticism of Islam generally is overstated. At the same time, there is a huge problem in the world with extremist Islam. And Islam is a belief system, or to me, it's actually a set of overlapping belief systems that needs to be discussed and questioned and argued about. And yet there are people who want to suppress criticism of Islam, people who want to suppress criticism of illegal immigration, or arguments about possible biological differences between sexes, or biological differences between races, or whatever else. Those are all things we need to be free to talk about. And yet, even if we think one answer is right or wrong on that, we can't even know which answer is right or wrong without the freedom to talk about it.
And that's what makes what you referenced earlier so disturbing, this wave of attempts at suppressing ideas, especially in university campuses, of at the very least shouting down people without hearing their positions or trying to get them disinvited from invitations to campus. It suggests an entire unwillingness to have any sort of conversation and to substitute for reasoned debate simply anger.
Well, so I think that's right. But note, I think there are several different things going on here. One thing is this principle that the government should not be suppressing ideas, the ideas expressed by private groups. A separate question, you raised the question of disinvitation. Mm-hmm. Disinvitations, I think, has to do more with a matter of openness and tolerance and willingness to debate. I think that, and that's not just me, the Supreme Court has said that student groups invite speakers. The university can't then cancel this invitation because of viewpoint. On the other hand, if the university invites a speaker, they could disinvite that speaker. It may be a breach of contract, perhaps. It probably would come across as quite rude, but the university, whom the university chooses to invite, they can disinvite. The problem with some such disinvitations is that they are that even if they're constitutional, they're bad for the university, because the whole point of a university should be to expose people to a vast range of views and to let them discuss those views. Now, I actually think that when it comes to university inviting speakers, I think university can pick and choose based on viewpoint. And again, the Supreme Court has told us that the government in its own speech can pick and choose. And yeah, I don't think there's anything particularly valuable about Nazi speech. If the law school is choosing whether to invite someone and I learn that he's a Nazi, I'm going to say, no, I don't want to invite him. I don't particularly want to hear from him, and I don't think it's going to benefit students. On the other hand, the problem is a lot of these disinvitations are basically if this person is a conservative, or if this person opposes same-sex marriage, or if this person opposes illegal immigration, or something along those lines. Let me give an illustration.
Please.
There are the kinds of ideas that we need to be able free to talk about, and why we should be free to talk. So it turns out that women are vastly underrepresented in certain institutions in American life. One of those institutions is prisons. Men are much more likely to be in prison than women. Now, it's an interesting question why this is so. Is it culture, just society, that pushes men to be more likely to go into criminal pursuits and women away from them? Is it discrimination, that prosecutors are more likely to throw the book at male defendants than at female defendants, and police officers are more likely to arrest them? Or is it biology, that there's something about male and female brains and hormonal systems and such that makes men more likely to be violent? This is a very interesting question. Women are also underrepresented in other fields. For example, women are underrepresented in science and mathematics.
I was wondering when we were going to get to Larry Summers. Please go on.
Right. So is that because of culture, that we are just training men to do one thing and women another? Is it because of discrimination, that women are being discriminatorily excluded from those fields? Or is it because biology, because there may be some difference in cognition or in temperament between men and women, that at least at levels of very substantial interest and very substantial skill yields different percentages? This too is an interesting question. What is the answer to either of those questions? And in fact, actually, the answer may be a mix. You could say it's a mix of culture and discrimination and maybe biology. These are interesting questions, but we can't know the answers to them if we rule one of the answers off the table from the outset. Even if you're confident, for example, that the reason that women are underrepresented in math and science has nothing to do with biology, let's assume that that is your belief and you're quite confident in it. You can't actually have any intellectually honest foundation for that confidence unless you know that the contrary views can constantly be expressed. Best of all is if you've heard those views and considered them yourself. But even if you don't, if you don't know enough about the subject because you're not a specialist and you're just deferring to the judgment of conventional wisdom among scholars, which is often a very reasonable thing to do, that's only a reliable conventional wisdom to the extent that it can constantly be challenged. If you know that particular views are being aired, but serious people who are studying them are rejecting them on the merits, then you could say that rejection is probably right. But if you know that those views are banned because they are sexist and misogynistic, and we refuse to allow them in universities, then that means you have less confidence in the opposite view. The only way to actually be an intellectually honest egalitarian is precisely if you know that the anti-egalitarian views can constantly be aired and are being rejected on the substance.
And that there's a free exchange of ideas. You said before you wouldn't be particularly interested in inviting a Nazi. I might actually be interested in inviting a Nazi because I think there's value in having a person come in with a completely invalid viewpoint that's backed up by nothing, and expressing it. And in other words, give him some rope and let him hang himself. And instead of encouraging or students or others in the audience to shout him down, they should listen and then get up and just completely dismantle his arguments.
You know, so I appreciate your point, and there is some value in that. when a university is choosing whom to invite, that's also a question of opportunity cost, right?
Yeah.
It's always value compared to what? There could be somebody else that they're listening to speak to. There could be somebody else that they could have opportunity to listen to. And in fact, sometimes it seems to me that we should be careful to invite people who are less extreme precisely because we want to hear the optimal presentation of the opposing views. Again, let's take an example with regard to radical Islam. I do think there ought to be a debate about what the problem is with radical Islam, to what extent it is a problem with Islam generally. What are the possible solutions to this problem? I would prefer solutions that are respectful of American traditions of religious freedom and religious equality, but there are all sorts of debates that you could have about that. I would rather not invite somebody who is a table thumping, expel all Muslims, bomb all their countries guy, just because I think that that doesn't do justice to his own argument.
Yeah,
that's somebody who it's easy to dismiss because he's obviously so ridiculous. I think it would be better to invite somebody who has a more thoughtful view that people, maybe it's still wrong, but that really challenges our contrary views.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we've just been speaking with Eugene Volokh of the Volokh Conspiracy blog on The Washington Post. And we've been talking about Nazis and free speech and whether the government can do anything about it. Later on, we'll hear from Richard Delgado, another law professor who specializes in the First Amendment. Stick around. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's continue our discussion with Eugene Volokh, the founder of something called the Volokh Conspiracy, a blog currently hosted by The Washington Post. We're talking about Nazis, political extremism, free speech, whether we can set any limits on such speech. Before the break, Eugene was telling me that he would like to hear more robust political debate, perhaps especially at places like universities, and that he would like to hear from people who are reasonable representatives, or perhaps the best representatives, of unpopular perspectives. This all seems to be self-evident to me. This to me is completely consistent with the entire idea of education and the university environment. And again, that's what makes it so troubling that not only students who might be forgiven given their immaturity, but some professors, notably the woman in Missouri, I believe her name was Melissa Click, who was expressing such disdain for the First Amendment and free speech as she was actively trying to suppress it on her own campus. And for heaven's sake, she was a professor of communications, I believe.
So I agree with you, but I do understand the rival view. And in fact, that is a view that is, I think, much more intuitive for many people. There's a great passage from Justice Holmes in one of his early First Amendment dissents, where he starts by saying, I'm sure you know this, but your audience might not, persecution for the expression of opinions, he says, seems to me perfectly logical. If you have no doubt of your premises or your power and want a certain result with all your heart, you naturally express your wishes in law and sweep away all opposition. This is perfectly logical. This is kind of instrumentally, look, we know this is wrong. If we allow people to say it, then some people might be persuaded. That's bad. Let's ban it. That's a standard attitude that people have. Again, it comes naturally, and it's been the attitude for most of human history and even today in much of the world. But then he gets to this passage, which I think people don't focus enough on. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, and that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting. He doesn't say that the marketplace of ideas will always yield truth. Some people caricature it that way. That's obviously false. We've seen situations where marketplace of ideas has yielded falsehood. He says the best test of truth. It's all compared to what? That it's not that it's perfect, but it's better than the alternative of letting the government decide what is truth and what is not, and ban things that it sees as false, or ban ideas it sees as false. But the other thing that he says, he talks about men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths. He's not just talking hypothetically. This is 1919. This is a time when we think it's sort of long in the past, in the primitive, almost horse and buggy era. But the people living at the time, it was a time that had been preceded by a breakneck pace of change in society, in science, of course, in technology, but also in beliefs, beliefs about God, that from a very that the world was becoming somewhat less religious, beliefs about political organization, beliefs about the role of women. This was right before voting rights for women was ratified. Beliefs we saw now capitalism at one point triumphing over free market capitalism over mercantilism, and then attempts to dislodge it with socialism. So he recognized that when best test of truth, the time has upset many fighting faiths, he was talking about the experience of his own era. And we see it today as well. Now, 100 years later, attitudes about a vast range of things, whether race or sex or sexual orientation or religion or other things, have changed sharply. So the question is, why should we believe that now we have found the truth, and now we know what everything's right, and now we can try to set it in stone so that people can't challenge it? That would be as mistaken now as I think it was back then.
Right. The Marketplace of Ideas passage that you quote, of course, is very famous. And I must say that, by and large, I've been a great believer in the Marketplace of Ideas, not as perfection, but as perhaps the best option we have. But I must admit that, you know, recent events, the advent of the internet, fake news, its impact perhaps on our electoral process, all of those have made me wonder whether that idea is as legitimate as I thought it was. I encapsulate the idea thusly. The Marketplace of Ideas is imperfect because some of us shop at Harris Teeter and the rest of us at Walmart, and never the twain shall meet. Is it possible we've got such a fragmented marketplace where people no longer speak to one another that the marketplace itself is failing?
Well, I think that that's something of an exaggeration. People do speak to each other. It's true that it is often more tempting for people just to listen to those on their own side. That's long been so. That's going to continue to be so. It may be a little bit easier now, but at the same time, there are also many more options available. If you want to read a newspaper, it used to be you could only read the newspaper in your own town. Now you can read thousands of newspapers from all over the world.
Yeah, I think that's the counter argument, because that's actually true. I mean, if you go back through history, most newspapers have been parochial and partisan.
Right. That was certainly true around the time of the framing of the Constitution. But even when they became ostensibly nonpartisan, of course, people's biases leaked through. Sometimes it was about conservative bias. In recent decades, most of the established media had something of a liberal bias, not sharp left, but still something of a liberal bias. And like many biases, one of the problems with it is it's hard to see your own biases. And then, of course, people who were actually on the far left were saying, oh, the bias is actually in favor of the status quo with maybe minor changes. That probably was also true. So now we have a lot more options. Now, options in a free country means just that people can read things, a wide range of things. They don't have to. We can't force them to. That's always a problem. And exactly how to deal with that is a difficult question. I will say it's funny you're talking, people are talking about fake news and talking about it as if it's something new. In fact, attempts to suppress fake news are as old as the country. The Sedition Act of 1798, now widely derided as an improper restriction and correctly derided as an improper restriction on a free press, was built by its backers, quite sincere people, as an attempt to fight essentially fake news. They were saying, look, this only bans false and malicious statements about the government, that in a democracy it's especially important that people not be deluded about their own government. And what's wrong with just banning falsehood? And what we saw quite promptly is that in implementation, it became a vehicle for suppressing opinions rather than actual facts. Likewise, around the same time as that Justice Holmes opinion that I quoted from, there was a case in 1920, the following year, Schaefer v. United States, mm-hmm. which had to do with a law that banned the publication of false reports about the war. The theory being that people who are our enemies, today maybe the Russians, back then it was the Germans, would be spreading these false reports about how supposedly we're doing so badly and there are all these reversals that would damage morale and thus interfere with the war effort. factually a plausible theory, but what happened was that this was used, of course, to shut down newspapers that were critical of the war effort, including some in the German emigre community in the U.S. And there, too, there was a pretty powerful dissent from Justice Brandeis' joined by Justice Holmes, that pointed out that this restriction was dangerous, and I think it would be dangerous if people tried to enact it today. Again, the question isn't, would we be better off with fewer Nazi ideas? Yes, we would. Would we be better off with less fake news? Absolutely. The question is whether we would be better off with the government getting to decide what ideas should be suppressed and what kind of news is fake.
So the remedy, to coin a phrase, the remedy for bad speech is not less speech, but more speech.
Well, it's not a perfect remedy. It's just the only one we've got that, or I shouldn't say the only one. It's the best one we've got, given the problems with the alternatives. It's like what Winston Churchill famously said, democracy is the worst of all possible systems except for all the alternatives. Likewise, free speech is the worst of all possible means of trying to make sure that people are making informed decisions except for all the alternatives.
Well, Eugene, that was absolutely fascinating. I really appreciate your taking your time to speak with us today. Any final thoughts?
No, I think we've covered a lot. And thanks very much for having me on.
And that was Eugene Volokh, a prominent First Amendment law professor from UCLA and the founder of the Volokh Conspiracy blog, which is available on the website of The Washington Post. Check it out. Now, Eugene is very much a champion of free speech and very, very protective of free speech and resists any attempt by the government to regulate it. On the other hand, there are differing viewpoints when it comes to Nazi speech, political extremism, which is our topic today. One law professor from the University of Alabama is a very prominent law professor in his own right. He's the founder of something called critical race theory, one of the founders anyway. His name is Richard Delgado. And Richard thinks that perhaps when it comes to Nazi speech and white supremacist speech, perhaps there are some limits that government can place on such speech while still protecting the First Amendment.
I'm Richard Delgado, and I'm the John J. Sparkman Chair of Law at the University of Alabama Law School, where I teach mainly civil rights. I am said to be a founder of critical race theory, dating back to some work I did about 30 years ago, and have been working in that area ever since. Basically, I teach students about the law, about the First Amendment, about speech and hate speech and stuff like that, discrimination at work, write articles, and every now and then write a book, sometimes with my dear wife, Jean Stefancic, who's also a professor of law. We have a new book coming out soon. Your audience might be interested in hearing about it. It's entitled Must We Defend Nazis, Hate Speech, White Supremacy, and the First Amendment.
You mentioned something called critical race theory. What exactly is that?
It's a school of civil rights scholarship that brings that area into the 21st century. It got started a few decades ago when a number of lawyers and law professors around the country figured out pretty much simultaneously that early anti-discrimination law was making fewer and fewer headways, particularly during times when modern-day racism was taking more and more subtle forms. We needed new legal theories to understand what was going on and to do something about it.
The first time I heard the phrase, if my memory is serving me correctly, was in a law school class over 30 years ago, and I think it was from my torts professor, a woman named Regina Austin. Do you know Regina?
Very well, yes. That's remarkable.
She is. She did a great job teaching torts, and she also was very eye-opening with pointing out things such as critical race theory that somebody from my background, which is sort of middle-class white from the Midwest, had just never really thought about before. All right, then. So critical race theory is your background, and of course, constitutional law as well. And that brings us to the subject of what we're looking at today, and that is, what can we do about all these Nazis and white supremacists who are marching all over the place and making such a ruckus?
Well, we can't bridle their speech merely because a person is a confirmed Nazi. with evil thoughts about the way the world should be. We can't tell them to stop talking. The Nazis are as entitled as you and I are to talk to their doctor about a fever, to order a meal at a restaurant, to talk with each other, even to say odious things to each other. When they want to march or when they want to give a talk on a campus that's torn with racial dissension, that's another matter.
And what exactly do you mean? Are there restrictions we can impose upon them in such a venue?
We can. We can tell them not to talk entirely. Private speech between Nazis on a university campus or while walking down a street of Charlottesville would be fine. And the First Amendment would certainly not contemplate that society can enact rules that they can't do that. Talk privately, quietly, one-on-one, or something of that nature. But when it comes to asking the rest of society for help, for a parade permit, meaning that other motorists have to stop and get out of the way, the police have to show up and protect them from people who don't like to see them, when they ask for the use of a large lecture hall at a university campus like yours or mine, then the person in charge has to make a discretionary decision. Do we want to do that? Do we want to incur those costs? Do we want to close down our streets? Do we want to let them have a lecture hall for three hours over somebody else who might want to give a lecture on some other academic subject? In that case, if the authorities turn them down, make a discretionary decision that that's not particularly valuable speech compared to other speech that is begging to be heard, then we don't have to rush to their defense. So the answer is complicated. A lot of Nazi speech is fine. We have to tolerate it, not like it, but have to tolerate it. But when they ask decision makers in society to make discretionary decisions about allocating them space, microphones, police services, janitorial services, cleaning up the lecture hall afterwards, then we, in most cases, are entitled to and should give them an emphatic no, get lost.
Well, as a matter of policy, I might agree with you. In fact, I suspect that I have a similarly low opinion of Nazis and racists and white supremacists that you do. But if we're talking, of course, about the government doing things that arguably infringe upon their First Amendment rights to express even odious ideas, isn't that going to run afoul of what the Supreme Court has said? We've got a very speech-protective Supreme Court at the moment, at least.
The government certainly shouldn't do that. The government is entitled to exercise its own discretion. When these characters want a university forum, when they want a microphone and a hall and want to put up posters at advertising and thus close the hall off to other speakers, nothing in the Constitution requires the authorities to help them speak, to lend support to their speech. The university doesn't have to speak that way. Charlottesville's city government doesn't have to speak along with them, help them out in their speech and in their march. That's pretty clear First Amendment law, and it makes sense to me and a lot of people.
Well, I think a university auditorium is one thing, perhaps, because there's an element, as you say, of the university deciding whom it wishes to invite in the first instance. But a traditional public forum, like a public square or a public park, if the Nazis show up and say they want to have a permit, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the person granting the permit is supposed to have almost no discretion. And the only sort of discretion or the only sort of decision he or she could make is with regard to time, place, and manner restrictions. But it's a no-no, a constitutional no-no for them to actually discriminate on the basis of content and certainly on the basis of viewpoint.
You're right about that. I wouldn't disagree with you there. The authorities may, of course, limit any speaker who's posing a pretty clear and immediate risk of violence. And if that is to say, the administrator knows that a speech, if given tomorrow in that site, it is going to cause a riot. You can say to any group who wants to speak. I'm very sorry, you'll have to wait until things simmer down. Nazis or the Quakers or anybody else.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week our subject is Nazis and political extremists and free speech, especially after Charlottesville. We've been speaking with Richard Delgado of the University of Alabama, and boy, is this a fascinating discussion. Stick around. And now it's time to continue our discussion about Nazis and white supremacists and free speech. We've been speaking today to two law professors. First, we heard from Eugene Volokh, who was very speech protective and didn't think that government could really do much about Nazi speech without infringing First Amendment rights. More recently, we've been hearing from Richard Delgado, and Richard has a slightly different take on this. He thinks that in some circumstances, at least, government can at least refuse to cooperate with political extremist speech. For example, by denying permits to Nazis who wish to march in the public square. When you give that sort of discretion to somebody, especially when it's predicting the future, which, of course, nobody can be certain of, doesn't that invite abuse? Isn't it then we're giving a lot of power to local officials to say, I really don't want anybody here because this viewpoint's unpopular, and I think maybe somebody will get angry and get violent?
Sure, that's always a possible problem when it's the government that is limiting or restricting speech, and that concern rises to a high level when the government censorship aims to protect government, to protect the governing party, or to insulate the grand leader from criticism, say a newspaper that wants to do that. Then of course your hackles and my hackles start to rise immediately. When the speaker is wanting to do something that will be scary, odious, harmful, or degrading to other citizens, then my own hackles about state censorship don't rise quite so quickly, because the government then is not trying to feather its own nest or make its own position more impregnable, but it is operating in order to defend civil peace, the feelings of Jewish people, the peaceful atmosphere of a campus or a campus town or something like that. Yeah, there have been periods in our history when government censorship has gotten out of hand. I don't see today as one where that is a particularly great threat.
But doesn't that create then something that's often called the heckler's veto? All I have to do to prevent speech I don't like is to threaten violence if it goes forward, and then the authorities are justified in preventing the speech simply to preserve civil order.
Yeah, that's true. That can happen. Probably does happen from time to time. As someone who lived through the 60s, I'm inclined to distrust. I used to distrust anybody over 30, but
it's funny how that one's timed out, hasn't it?
Yes, it sure is. A pass quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does.
But everyone should retain a certain amount of distrust for government, because it's big, it's powerful, it has a loud voice, it can do quite a bit of harm when it wants to. But, you know, government makes discretionary decisions in the area of speech all the time. It makes close calls. When the courts say, I mean, courts are an arm of government, when they decide whether a particular speech is defamation or not, whether certain speech is libelous or not, they're making close calls, and we hope that they're making them the right way. We don't invent heckler's vetoes or other kind of far-fetched reasons why we have to discard the doctrine of defamation or libel. And the same with all those other exceptional categories that I'm sure you and your listeners know about: words of threat, words that are contemptuous of a judge, words that that amount to shouting fire in a crowded theater. Now, all of those exceptions require that someone draw a line. Often it's a judge or other government actor. And somebody has to draw sensible, meaningful lines, and otherwise life wouldn't go on.
Yeah, you're correct, Richard. There are exceptions to the First Amendment, and they do require, if they go to court, some judge to decide whether, for example, there's been a true threat or not, whether there has been defamation or not. I guess what troubles me is that when we move into a realm of what's commonly called core political speech, that's really typically been the highest level, the highest protected type of speech. And as anathema as the Nazi ideology is, it is a political ideology. And the Nazis or the Klansmen or other white supremacist groups might argue that they have just as much right to go into the public square and explain how they think society should be ordered as Democrats or Republicans or members of the NAACP.
As an initial proposition, that's certainly true, and I don't discount it. They would like to change the government and social policy and the way we live in a certain direction, the Nazi or the white supremacist direction. So their speech is, in that sense, classical political speech. But unlike lots of political speech, which of course we should protect, their speech and their program and their action threatens and endangers other constitutional values too, such as equality and the desire that most people have that we all live in an atmosphere of respect for people of different colors, different races, different sexual orientations, different immigration statuses, and so on. So that if one constitutional principle, like the First Amendment, collides with or endangers several others that we also subscribe to, or worse yet, threaten the entire constitutional system, as certain speech and advocacy does, then other values come in, and the courts and any rational decision makers have to balance, because then things are not quite so simple.
Well, you make a very good point. Equality is just as much a constitutional value as is free speech. They're both right there in the Constitution. In fact,
We fought a war over one, you know.
Oh, yes, we certainly did. I mean, it's the only time we've had a civil war over a constitutional issue.
Feel strongly about it.
Oh, yeah. That's a very, very important, very, very important constitutional value. And it occurs to me that one can make a legislative interpretation argument, say the 14th Amendment is later adopted than the First Amendment, and therefore it should prevail, that we were fully aware of the First Amendment when we adopted the 14th, and therefore equality should prevail in these circumstances. But there's the rub. The rub is that conflict between those two concepts. I'll agree with you to some extent that the ideal circumstance is an environment where people are free to express ideas and yet perhaps not engage in ad hominem attacks, especially based upon immutable characteristics like race or ethnicity. In fact, I must note that that's the rule that I impose in my classes. I actually put it in my syllabus. I want everybody free to discuss ideas as long as we're being respectful of each other. So I, in some sense, I'm sounding like a hypocrite when I impose that own rule in my classroom. And yet, when I quail at the idea of the government deciding what is within or outside of limits.
I can't do much more than repeat what I said. When the government is regulating interpersonal speech between, six big fraternity kids who set upon a lone undergraduate of color walking home late at night from the campus library after studying, I come down on the side of those who see the harm that they're perpetrating on the undergraduate as more serious than the harm that the crowd setting on him suffer when the university tells him stop doing that. We don't agree with what you're doing, and if you do that again, we're going to suspend you.
Let's get a little bit concrete then. If David Duke or Richard Spencer or somebody else who is identified with this ideology wanted to come and have a permit, let's say in the city of Knoxville, Tennessee, where I live, and people were reacting strongly to it, and there's always the potential of violence at such a rally between the demonstrators pro and con, it would be your position then that based upon the content of the proposed speech, which would advocate some sort of racial inequality, that the city, the government, would be justified in denying a permit to that proposed speaker.
If I were the university council, I would defend that decision. I'd want to see, a good statement of reasons why that speaker's appearance was very likely to produce disorder, anger, violence, demoralization. I don't know those two speakers that you mentioned, but I've read about them. And if I were the university council and a university administrator asked for my opinion, I think that I would come down on their side if they wanted to turn down the request for a permit.
Okay. More generally, whenever we talk about exceptions to the First Amendment, we talk about line drawing, we talk about definitions. We've been talking about the easy case. I mean, I think the Nazis are pretty much some of the vilest people out there. But many more mainstream ideas still cause a great deal of offense. In fact, right now, we seem to be at a very polarized position in our history. And I can see some people on the left getting not mad just at Nazis, but at Republican speakers, conservative speakers, who will vehemently deny that they are Nazis or that they share Nazi ideology and yet express ideas that people on the left find extremely offensive. You mentioned immigration, for example. So if a conservative speaker wanted to come to Knoxville and advocate for essentially closing the borders, would that be something that we could deny a permit for because it was going to provoke such potentially violent reactions from some people on the left?
Well, every now and then there will be a very close call. That's inherent in our system of laws, in which we trade the security of simply stated rules, a system of simply stated rules, and weigh that against a certain degree of uncertainty at the periphery, where there seems to be no clear-cut rule. We do this all the time. Otherwise, it would be impossible to distinguish between night and day, mm-hmm. because they're close calls. There's dusk and there's dawn, and where exactly do you draw the line between dusk and dawn? And of course, the police need to give a ticket to drivers who are driving during the night with their lights off, and so we enact a rule that you should turn your lights on, headlights on, when it's night. That doesn't deter us from enacting a rule like that. There'll be a lot of clear-cut cases, many more clear-cut cases than ones that are at the periphery and require head-scratching and line drawing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a head-scratching area if ever there was one. I've been using a lot of examples of people on the left wanting to suppress people on the right, but I'm also reminded by something you said about speech that threatens our very democracy. I'm reminded of the McCarthy era. And in that era, you had relatively conservative people in charge of government who were persecuting people on the left, labeling them as communists or inquiring as to their communist membership. And their rationale was always that communist ideology advocated the forceful overthrow of the government. And that was their hook. You know, if you're a communist, if you buy into this, then you are threatening the very foundations of our democracy. Maybe you're even threatening violence in the near term. And that's how the McCarthyites justified persecuting the people on the left. Isn't there a danger of that if we allow the government to say what's acceptable?
Well, those were lies. It's not true that your closet socialist professor with a tweed jacket, who did believe that society ought to be more collective and we ought to be more concerned about each other and we should share share resources and share goods and look after poor people and who is either an apologetic socialist or an unapologetic socialist. It's just not true, probably not true, that he advocated and believed in the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. Maybe one or two did, but to say that all of them were that way, that was just a lie.
Well, I'll agree with you on that, but that's my point, is that the government engaged in lies and was able to get away with it, at least during that time, because people thought that the government was justified in restricting speech that was, in some sense, threatening to our democracy. I mean, I'm certainly not defending the McCarthyites. I'm just taking it as an example of the right rather than the left abusing governmental power.
Well, I think that you and I may have a slight disagreement here. I don't think that the case of governmental officers who are prepared to act based on flat-out lies is particularly interesting. We ought to vote them out of office as soon as possible. We should punish them when they lie. But these are not particularly interesting First Amendment problems. Nazis are, hate speakers are. The eight fraternity kids who set upon the black undergraduate and holler at him and tell him he should go back to Africa or whatever, he doesn't belong on campus, affirmative action baby. That's an interesting case, and I know how I come down, and I have my reasons, and I wrote a book about it. But the governmental figure who lies about particular people being dangerous or ridiculous, that's not a First Amendment problem. That's a problem for our political system, there are always scoundrels everywhere.
Well, Richard, you did write a book relatively recently with your wife and colleague. Could you tell us what the title is?
Yes, it's Must We Defend Nazis? Let's see, what's the rest after the colon? Hate Speech and White Supremacy Under the First Amendment. The publisher is New York University Press, and the book builds on various things that we've written in the past brings our previous writing up to date, talks about Charlottesville, talks about Nazis and white supremacy. And your readers can find it at the best bookstores in about 1 month. It's a paperback book, and the price is relatively cheap.
That should be available for Christmas 2017, then.
There you are.
A good stocking stuffer. And who is your co-author?
Jean Stefancic, my dear wife. She's a much more engaging person to talk with than I am. She's much less doctrinaire. She has a great sense of humor. I think you'll enjoy very much meeting her. And I'll tell her to look for your byline in her email down the line.
All right. Thanks very much, Richard.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our two guests, Eugene Volokh from UCLA and Richard Delgado, whom we just heard from the University of Alabama. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our production intern is Donald Crenshaw. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.